Thursday, June 25th, 12 noon, exactly. John Rivette interviewing Ken Germanson, formerly of the Allied Industrial Workers, previously known as the UAW-AFL, kind of a pre-interview, but I think we've done a few, so I don't know if pre's the right word.
Hello, John.
Hi, Ken. Is this good still?
Oh, yeah, it's great, and you just, my God, you split hairs on that 11 o'clock. Good for you.
Okay.
Yeah, fine.
So, as I said recently, there are a variety of things I want to chat with you at some point, and so at some way it doesn't really matter to what extent we get into the Labor History Society or things you learned about UAW, AFL, AIW from your interviewing or your personal experience, our projects and what we might do in terms of creating video or articles or any of that. It sort of doesn't matter. I assume, quite honestly, that we might do, you know, a dozen hours of interview. It doesn't matter. And so I had a variety of things today. There's some of which I said maybe we'd talk about, so you may have kind of wanted to look at some things and chat about those. Briefly, let me just tell you what I spread out in some books and magazines, just thoughts for to chat.
Sure, go ahead.
I'll just give you the list, and then I'll shut up. So I pulled out the famous Illinois Labor History Society video on Memorial Day Massacre, because that triggered, not that per se, but Bill Adelman's work triggered when I worked for High and Joyce Kornbluh in 76, 77, into us doing some things that led to having Bill come into Ann Arbor, which led to the Michigan Labor History Society. So next to that, I have your Bayview Massacre, which I know has something to do with your neck of the woods. Next to that, I have some issues of the Wisconsin Labor History Society, which I know you've been active with. And then I have things about the UAW-AFL, like a convention proceeding I pulled. I pulled out Lisa Fine's Rio Joe, thinking about you doing the Washburn interview. I grabbed a video on Gabe Jewell, which you did in 99. One I did on Walt Campbell, similar time period. Some government documents related to investigating the union corruption story of the 1950s, and something about right to work, both historic, something way back from the CIO published about the case against right to work, and then this article I hope you saw recently the New York Times did on labor's last stance about Scott Walker. So any and all of those or other things is just fine with me. At some point, I will send you the release form if I haven't done that already. So, any order you want to go is great.
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, John, I'm curious as you've come up with a number of angles, a number of ideas. Can you hear me all right?
I hear you just fine.
Because I put you on speaker. But anyway, I was just curious as to what you think you would like, where you'd like to go with this, because I think rather than do a scattershot on a whole bunch of stuff, maybe we ought to kind of set some priorities as to what we should concentrate on. Although if you would wish to do a general conversation now on all of this material, that's fine. But I'm just curious as to what your thoughts were as to what you want to do with this, or is that something that we should discuss?
I see this as a one level, a project you and I have worked on for way too long. We both have wanted to see somebody else and or ourselves pick up the AIW story because of your career, a little bit me. I don't know if you recall, but Jeff McDonald was part of the MSU Labor Ed program. And he was at MSU when I was hired in 70. I started in the summer of 77, but I actually started doing some things with MSU in the winter of 77, and Jeff was living in Ann Arbor, and I would ride with him up. So anyways, we became friends, and then he was hired by AIW and Ray McDonald to be his assistant and left MSU. And then also Wisconsin's university labor ed program was quite renowned in its health and safety. And under Jeff and then Scott Toby, they kind of directed our federal Carter administration, which continued for the first Reagan administration, occupational health and safety program, and ours was the university program in the state. And the School of Workers did training of new labor educators. So I came over several times to Milwaukee and Madison for those things, and because of Jeff, came over and visited, and I have some recollections of partying with Ray and Jeff and their spouses, and Diane Rivette came on a couple of those. So that added, just to finish about me, some personal interaction, and I would assume I met you somewhere around circa 1980 because of that.
And we did a number of labor education programs at Michigan State for Region 7.
Right.
And so I think you were around for some of those, yeah.
Absolutely, and I was active from grad school at UMass Amherst in something called Workers' Education Local 189, which was an interesting organization of labor educators working for unions and universities.
Right.
And George Datesman was part of the leadership of that.
Right.
And
Rommel McCoy also.
I didn't know Rommel. Who I remember was George, was just a wonderful man. And he had a good buddy with the Molders called Jimmy Wolf.
Exactly.
And so, you know, those were a couple guys that I would add to my list of mentors in the worker ed field. And some of that related, obviously, to AIW. And like you said, we did training programs in Lansing. We also did one night a week for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, classes in different parts of the state. And Lansing had a large local called Motor Wheel.
Oh, yeah. Because I know a lot about that.
Right. And so I started doing classes there and got to know Bill Brayman, who also was the Labor Council president, Mike Pine, and various people related to that. Through all these things, I got to know Walt Campbell, who was kind of a hero icon in the Michigan labor movement. And I interviewed him numerous times. So I had this personal affinity for AIW, and then the more I learned, since UAW is so large, the regular UAW, CIO, at various points it got interesting to think about how they're similar and how they're different. And if I were to say a research question to part of your point, I find it interesting, is it true that the UAW CIO was significantly different related to collective bargaining, health and safety, discrimination, different internal union issues and bargaining and grievance things? Is it significantly different than the UAW versus AIW in those ways? In the industries they share, which was auto parts and supplies, some foundries and forges. So in terms of questions as a researcher, which is something I'm enjoying spending some time now. I'm not an administrator, but still enjoying faculty kind of intellectual life, whatever. That interests me a lot. And I could see us doing some interviews, some research, presentations, I don't know, papers, different ways it can be written up. It can be written up in state, like this Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois Labor History Society journals, or in more academic things. I don't really care. But so those are all interests of mine, as well as particulars. Like, reason I brought up Right to Work is because I helped get us committed to do a panel here in the North American Labor History Society about Wisconsin and Michigan Right to Work. So it's kind of on the side of my mind thinking about that topic. So I also, as I said, you know, we've had fun doing this, but I'd like to make sure in the next year or two that we do something beyond just chat about it.
Well, I totally agree, and that's why I was saying we need to focus on something, or at least prioritize where we think we are going. Because, I mean, I turn 86 in August, and who knows how long I'm going to be functioning. And, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to function forever. But the reality is something else, of course.
Well, same for me. I'm going to be turning in the fall 65, and for some people that's a momentous kind of thing. And while I expect and hope to live as long as my mother did into her 95, I could die this afternoon. So,
we're at that age, both of us, where that's a very real effect. I almost died of a heart attack when I turned 80 because I had a very massive one, and luckily it was very close to the hospital. But so, I'm here, and it looks like I'm going to survive for a while. But anyway, so what I'd like to do would be to kind of focus on one or two items and do those.
Great.
Keeping in mind the other thing.
That's fine.
And I would like to probably concentrate basically on the AIW or the UAW in Pavel.
Good.
Personally, and that's where I'd like to go.
Go for it.
And I went over the three basic questions that you raised prior to this conversation, which were the racial things, and the comparison between the UAWA, CIO, and our union. And to kind of go down them real quickly, one, two, three, I'm going to start with the comparison that you were just talking about, the differences. And I think, by and large, at the local union level, I'm not sure there was a tremendous amount of difference. And because observing where we were with all that was that, at least during my years, our locals were as militant and as interested to and as involved as CIO locals. Now, there was a major difference in that our locals were primarily located in smaller communities. They weren't located in the, you know. And so we're more rural-based industrial union than the CIO, although the CIO had plenty of those too. And so I think there's a little difference in the type of union member we had.
Uh-huh.
And they would tend to be more white, and they would, you know, tend to be probably less militant.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we had our share of strikes. I was just looking at something last night, and I think we in our small union had 35 strikes in 1985 to which we paid benefits. You know, so they were the the sidelines. There was, I think, a basic difference early on, and that's that the CIO locals issued or did not favor the use of arbitration.
Uh-huh.
Whereas I think we were a little closer to it because I'm not sure we felt as confident to be able to strike over grievances as they were. I think there was other differences at the top level, partly due to the size, of course, but secondly, due a little bit to the fact that our foundation was in the anti-communist era and the red-baiting era, and we were unfortunately born in our early years, after World War II, more of a red-baiting thing. And even in the Homer Martin thing, I mean, you go back to the late 30s, and if you look at what we had in our prior to the AIW days, while we were still UAW-PFL, we were pretty right-wing oriented as far as our national politics were concerned, the anti-communist threat, which we overplayed shamefully, and and did a lot of red tape.
You're talking about stuff before you were there, right?
Yeah, that was before, but we've got that very well or somewhat documented by both the oral interviews of both Dominic D'Ambrosio and Gilbert Jewell, and other stuff, plus a lot of our materials from our newsletters, which should be examined closely, and also of our conventions. I had access to all of those, beginning from 1935 right up to the time when we were in Milwaukee. We had all of them on the file. And I hope they all survived the move to Nashville and now up to Pittsburgh. So that's a real resource. That gets you into all of the. Those proceedings are surprisingly good, and they will show you where we were standing. So there was, and then of course we have the famous in the UAW-AFL CIO story. A movie produced in the middle 50s while we were located in Los Angeles with Ronald Reagan as the narrator. You're aware of that, I presume.
Why don't you state for the record what it is?
What it amounts to is a movie that was produced. It's an hour-long movie. It's basically a piece of pro-UAW-AFL propaganda. And it was produced at great expense in Hollywood, and it had a number of B-level actors reenacting parts. No, seriously.
No, I know.
There were guys that you might have recognized in B-movies, and still credible actors, of course, and then narrated by the only big name, of course, was Ronnie Reagan at that
time. Is this We Make a Difference? The name?
No, I think it was the UAW-AFL story. I think that's what it was called.
UAW-AFL story. Okay.
I saw it.
Maybe I don't have a copy.
You do have or don't?
I may not.
Yeah, well, it should be in our archives in wherever they are now, Pittsburgh.
So you,
and I'm presuming that at some point before it deteriorates, we ought to get a copy.
You don't have a copy?
Huh?
You do not have a copy.
I do not have a copy, though.
Okay.
It's one of my regrets. And it was such a bad movie in the sense that once the AIW was created and we had the reform in 57, all the new officers didn't want to have anything to do with it. Because basically what it did it showed how the UAW-AFL folks went after the communists in the union. And it was a red-baiting movie, and, on the order of some of those old FBI stories that you maybe saw in black and white movies right after the war. And, like I was an undercover agent for the FBI or whatever that was. Anyway.
Do you want me to interject or just let you go?
Well, that was basically what I wanted to say about the comparison.
Right.
So if you've got a question about that, yeah, then I'll get into the other two.
Go ahead. I'll jot notes and get back.
Okay. Now, on the racial thing, that is more interesting. Of course, we were, during the split, when the split occurred in 39 and the efforts leading up to that, there was a lot of, hoarding of some black members. And, of course, at that point, we were competing in the same large plants in the urban areas as the CIO was.
Mm-hmm.
And there were both unions operating in most of the auto plants during the 30s, after 39, with the two unions existed side by side up until 1941 when the first NLRB vote was held. So there was an effort, so the AFL portion, of course, before any other union did this, we elected as a vice president at large, called it, believe it or not, he was actually called the Negro vice president.
I believe it.
And that was, Frank Evans was the first one elected into that position. Frank was a very, very interesting guy. Very well spoken, very well dressed.
Where'd he come from?
He came from Cleveland.
Okay.
And he was, he got close to Homer Martin and was his bodyguard, because Frank was about 6 feet four or five and husky and well built and, and a very handsome man.
Was he a worker in a factory or?
I can't remember what his first, I'd have to go back and look.
That's okay.
I don't remember, but he got close to Homer Martin and then,
mm-hmm.
It may have been a political payoff as much as anything to try to get the black votes to support the AFL, And so they made him a Negro vice president at large, and a couple of conventions later changed it to a vice president at large and dropped the Negro part of it. And then that was, while it was never stated in any words per se, that was always perceived to be a position on the executive board that was reserved for a black man. And Frank held that position well into the 70s, because I worked with him. He was still on the board. And then he was replaced, I believe, with Charlie Street, who was also black. But eventually that became a contention within the union, because we had some Hispanic members and we elected a Hispanic member to that position, and there's no blacks left on the board then. And ironically, the Hispanic member couldn't speak Spanish. He was born and raised in Milwaukee.
Where did Charlie Street come from?
I'm sorry?
Where did Charlie Street come from?
He came from Youngstown. He was
in
the local 287, which was amalgamated. I'm not sure Charlie ever physically worked in the factory. I can't recall. He actually was a journalism school graduate from Youngstown State, I believe. But it could have been some other university.
I sort of remember that name, but I don't remember if I read it or what.
He's a very good-looking guy and very personable and probably fighting politician. And that was a, frankly, that's about the limit. I loved him personally. He and I traveled a lot, but as far as a leader was concerned, I'm not sure he was the greatest. And then Mary Gilday replaced Andy Burdine, who was the Hispanic vice president. And that's when they decided we needed a woman on the board. Up 89 or 87, somewhere in there. Those are all in the records, of course. But anyway, Dom, what was interesting was that what happened locally, because it varied region and local by local. In other words, our locals in regions pretty well reflected the local customs.
Right.
And I remember Dom, in fact, I was looking at Dom's videos and his interviews. He's got a couple of very interesting incidents where we had never organized in Tennessee until the early 50s when a company from Milwaukee called Koehring, Koehring, which means earth-moving equipment, moved its production to Chattanooga. And the AFL at that time suggested that we go down and try to represent them because they were represented by the machinists up here.
Oh, okay.
So we organized down there, and Dom goes down and he says the first thing we noticed that we had to hold our organizing meetings both in black neighborhoods and in white neighborhoods because the guys wouldn't go into each other's neighborhoods, of course. And he talks about the local unions down there while the trades always had separate locals. The industrial unions did, but the locals still had separate meetings. In other words, a local 222, which was one of our locals down there, would have a black meeting or a Negro meeting, they would call it, and a white meeting. And that kind of horseshit. So Dom said he went down there and they decided right off the bat that would end, which it did.
Mid-50s?
Yes. Early 50s, actually, when Dom first got on staff, which was 49. And then he tells the story of, when they'd get to the meetings, they would separate. They'd have the single meeting, but the blacks would sit on one side, the whites on the other. And in the shops, even though they removed all mention of race in the contracts, the whites still knew which jobs were theirs, and the blacks would never fit into a white job, even though the worker might have this greater seniority. So there was still, that took a while through education.
And our
union actually, particularly after in the early 60s began to really become conscious at the national level that we needed to educate in this area. And we did institute a number of things to move forward there. And then hiring people like George Statesman, in 1970 or 71 really helped spur that forward on.
What did George come out of that he particularly was helpful?
You asked where George came from?
And why was he particularly helpful about discrimination issues?
Well, George actually he and his wife are a very interesting story in their own sense, is that George was in World War II, first
right.
He was discharge, he went to Rutgers.
Mm-hmm.
And he graduated from Rutgers, I believe, in history. I'm not sure where, but anyway.
Me neither.
And so, George then went to work in the I think it was a Ford plant in Linden, New Jersey. Or it could have been a GM.
Did you ever interview George, or did anyone?
I'm sorry?
Did you or anyone ever interview George on any kind of tape?
No, unfortunately, we didn't. And
okay.
He and I were very close friends, and his wife, his widow, is still part of our group that goes to see the Milwaukee Rift place. We've been doing that since the early 60s.
Has anyone from your society interviewed her?
No.
Oh,
we haven't. Rose is still alive.
Yeah, I know.
She's about 90 and doing pretty good. We see her on a regular basis, so we could do that.
I would encourage you to think of doing it. I know I attended your conference a couple years ago in Milwaukee. Wasn't this year, so the year before or two back. And I hadn't seen her in a long time, and she was there. And I think you had a little leaflet about it, George Statesman. This is the Wisconsin Labor History Society.
Yeah, we give very small mini grants of $300 to any local group.
To his name.
That wants to do something about labor history in their community.
Yeah. Right. And it was in George's name.
Because she gave when he died in 1991, took about $1,000 or so, and we started that fund with it.
Yeah. I had not seen her for a very, very long time, and it brought back memories about both George and Jim Wolf.
Well, there's two very... Anyway, George and she were very active in the anti-war movement, and they got arrested, and they spent 6 months in jail for splashing paint some sort of a monument in New York City.
My recollection was that he was involved in Communist Party or some left-wing political party things. And
well, definitely, I'm never quite sure if they were actual Communist Party members. They
right.
were certainly in those days what we all sympathized with.
Right, exactly.
And,
not important, but
if I had had any courage at that time, I would have been with them. So.
all I'm saying is if you get a chance, I would hope you just turn on a tape recorder sometime with Rose and talk to her.
Anyway, just to make a long story short about the Rachel stuff so we get that off the table, is that it varied from local to local. I got
sure.
some anecdotal stuff that's quite interesting about that. Dom has a couple of very revealing incidents, which he relates. And,
is that one of your VHS tapes or one of your audio?
They're digital discs now. They're DVDs. I got them on DVD.
Okay, I don't know that I have those, so.
Yeah, well, I can make a copy and.
Please do.
And then, there's some excellent stuff on there.
Yeah.
Dom's always very good on details. Sometimes he bores you to death with them, but at least it's good. It's great for him this morning.
One of the things I pulled out for today was our May 23rd, 2012 AIW reunion in Cleveland. You sent me a copy of that unedited interviews.
Yeah, so some of that is in that tape because because he talked a great deal during that session.
And it was wonderful.
Some of that did him. It's just a touch at first. That Gabe's whole thing, and then when we go into the corruption.
Before you go.
I'm going to point out that we were not insensitive to racial issues in the UAW, AFL, NAIW, but that it was spotty, that it was, and probably very typical of most unions, which had to reflect their local communities.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some courageous stands. I mean, Dom tells a couple stories down there, and where they, stood up to it. So we had that, and so on the corruption thing, that is a significant story, and I think needs to be carefully reported, because I'm curious about this paper this guy from Louisiana Tech put in.
Yeah, me too.
You contacted him at all?
I haven't yet. I just got that same email I forwarded to you, 48 hours ago or something?
No, it was just a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
I think one of us should contact him and ask for a copy of it.
You want to go ahead and do that, or?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to go ahead and do that, or are you asking me to?
Well, I think as an academic, you should ask.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's peer-to-peer,
Understood. He'd probably respond quicker to you, though, but that's okay.
well, then, if you think that's the way, I have no problem email. I did look him up. He's got an email address.
Oh, go ahead and do it, because especially if you tell him that you used to work for the union and... you could tell him you and I are going to give a talk here, and we've been working on a project, and as I read what Tom Klug wrote to me just, I think, yesterday, he was suggesting, why don't you, meaning John, and Ken, put together a panel for next year, fall of 2016, about the AIW. And it can be on a variety of themes, and here's another person who could be on your panel. That's how I read it.
Okay. Well, I'll contact him and see what it all amounts to.
Oh, I'm sure he'll send a copy of his paper. It might have been published since or not.
I have no idea.
Often these things, it could be a dissertation for him.
Yeah.
And, there was somebody else within the last decade who did something about AIW. And, quite frankly, I've got a lot of labor history stuff, and I have a whole shelf that relates to AIW stuff. Because, I keep pulling things together because I interviewed Brayman or Campbell or some others. And we talked about trying to do something, and then for Cleveland I pulled together things. You may remember I Xeroxed a lot of parts of documents for handing out to those retirees.
Right, and so, I still have those, yeah.
So there's a lot of things that you and I have learned for various reasons. I still have several thoughts about what outcomes possible. But I think it's important for us to flesh out some of these stories like we're doing right now.
I mean, I would love to tell the story of corruption and how we got out of it. And because I think it's a better story than it, because we kind of hit it.
Uh-huh.
Because it was a difficult thing to explain. And if you look, one of the points Don made in his DVD in his video interview, that was done in the year 2000, after his retirement.
Uh-huh.
One of the points Don made, which I thought was very good, he says, we virtually lost no members when that whole corruption thing came up. And he said, it was the loyalty of our members for our organization that permitted us to survive that event, and which speaks to the strength of our union in a small way, because there was great respect local by local. In other words, the corruption was just in two places, Chicago and New York. And in the international persona of Tony Doria. And it did not filter down to the locals, except for these two phony situations that were established. And it was Tony Doria's skillful maneuvering of the executive board, and he was a very talented, brilliant guy, who was able to maintain this craft going on and count people. And Lester Washburn, of course, talks about that in his interview. The one thing both Dom and Dave Jewell and Lester all agree on is that Tony Doria was an extremely competent, capable guy who went screwing, you know, on us.
Uh-huh.
And so I think the important thing to say about the corruption thing isn't that, and that I got a little worried about the title of that paper of that guy from Louisiana Tech, was that it sounded like the UAW-AFL was a terribly corrupt organization.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a couple of pockets were, but the majority of the workers were identified mainly with the local unions and the regional leadership.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing corrupt about Ed Donahue and Walt Campbell, and you knew both of them.
Right.
Or at least you knew Walt.
Yeah.
And there was nothing corrupt about Dominic D. Ambrosier. He's so fucking clean and makes you sick. You know? And that used to get Ray McDonald and I mad because he did everything by principle, you know. But, you know, those are the kind of things. And so, and of course, we fought that for years after it was cleaned up. But, so that's a point we would like to make. And I think that would be a good story to tell, because it shows all the warts and the strengths of strong local unions and solidarity within those unions. So those are my three points, and I got a lot of elaboration on each of them, of course, except that the differences between the UAW and a CIO and ourselves, which I think we need to talk with, you know, Ray McDonald and a few other people more directly.
Got some points or questions. So I heard it as discrimination and corruption. What was the third point? How were you dividing it?
What's that?
You said those were three points.
Well, I was talking about the three questions you raised was
right.
All I was talking about. One was the comparison between the two unions. One was the racism, and the other was...
Okay.
So I addressed those three points in a general sense.
Okay. Because on the comparison, I don't think we really touched on what I was thinking about, which is fine. But
I don't think I have an answer to that.
Yeah, and it may be that it's Ray. And it may be some other people that were on your staff... I don't remember the health and safety person's name anymore.
Well, that is Milan Racic.
Thank you.
And he's alive and he lives in Milwaukee, and I talk to him periodically.
Anyways, the UAW-AFL versus UAW-CIO story has been written up for different parts, mostly sort of the first several years of it. Mostly focused on Homer Martin versus the CIO leadership.
Exactly.
And mostly people haven't paid much attention to the UAW-AFL after that, except for picking up about the corruption story. And because Michigan had a fair amount of AIW, and my job as a labor educator had me doing things in Lansing and the west side of the state, I got to know some people in those locals. And I also had Lansing, which included an amalgamated local, 724, that was the Drop Forge local. And so I worked with both of them a lot, and then other ones scattered around West Michigan.
But with you, 724 was CIO, right?
Exactly right, sorry.
Because okay. I didn't remember that number.
No, it's not yours. No, it's UAW-CIO. But an amalgamated local, and I don't know what it was like in Wisconsin, but in Michigan, in the 70s and 80s, the UAW was big and important enough that they didn't depend much on the university labor education programs. They did their own thing.
You are talking about the CIO.
Correct.
Yes, you are correct.
And
in Wisconsin as well.
Okay.
We depended very heavily on the school for workers here, yes.
Exactly. And here in Michigan, the UAW AFL-CIO would be the real name at the time, in the late 70s through the 90s, the GM, Ford, Chrysler locals were, while we did some things for top leadership and big programs, mostly the University Labor Ed program didn't do a lot of basic stuff for them. They had Black Lake and they had their own regional education directors, etc. But the amalgamated locals like UAW 724 in Lansing, which was the Drop Forge local, they depended on us a lot more. And I ran a lot of classes for UAW 724. So, as well as for Motor Wheel, and I could name other ones across the kind of, especially across the west side of the state. There were a few Detroit locals, but in Michigan, mostly the AIW, other than Motor Wheel and Checkers Motors in Kalamazoo, other than those two big exceptions, mostly the AIW just held on to parts supplies and things along the coast, the Lake Michigan coast.
Well, that's right. Muskegon and Ludington and
right.
And so forth, yeah.
So I personally got to experience doing programs, doing grievance handling or labor law or whatever, for these UAW AFL-CIO locals and in the parts supply industry, the small kids, and these AIW plants, mostly similar size. And as I said, as a as an academic, one would say, you could phrase it in different ways, but is there a hill of beans of difference between them? In terms of what they negotiate, what they're able to achieve in wages, pensions, benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And my overall theory would, conclusion before researching this, they're pretty similar.
Well, that is my conclusion too. And if there's a little bit of difference in the fact that the UAW, and particularly as we got into the 60s and the split occurred largely over the Vietnam War stuff.
Uh-huh.
When the UAW pulled out of the AFL-CIO. And one of the issues I would have with the CIO folks, and I dearly love them, don't get me wrong.
Right.
You know, we all have our little issues. And was that they were too insular in the sense that we can do it ourselves. We don't need anybody
exactly
around. And that was good because it created great pride within their groups. Smaller units. companies like ours were dependent upon the AFL-CIO. Dependent. I mean, we used, George got disenchanted with the school for workers largely because he got disenchanted with Bob Roseanne, who was our director at that time at the school for workers. So we spent a lot of time down in Indiana because he liked the guys down at Indiana. But we were dependent upon folks like Michigan State and UW and Indy and even Arkansas and Nebraska had some kind of labor education because we always involved those folks when we did our bargaining conferences.
So, obviously, if I were to add other topics to chat with it sometime, I obviously am interested in your experiences in university and union worker education. And I think I mentioned to you a person I've interviewed several times and become friends with is a gentleman named Oscar Pascal.
And where's Oscar? I don't know him.
Right. He came out of Detroit Chrysler UAW local.
Mm-hmm.
Off the top of my head, I must say number 6, a very low number. And in the UAW CIO, the number started from when they organized from the beginning. So this was one of the first. Oscar wasn't there right at the beginning, but pretty soon after. And after a while, for various reasons, he ends up on the staff of the UAW Education Department. And we met when I worked for High and Joyce Kornbluh at the University of Michigan Labor Studies Center in 76, 77. So we've known each other a long time. And he worked a career as UAW Education Department and then UAW Chrysler Joint Training Center, and he's been a close friend of Dave Elsala for a long time. So, anyways, I've interviewed Oscar about some of these kind of questions.
Sure.
And posed questions to him about the Labor History Society in Michigan. He knows insider stuff, as do I, but a different perspective. Questions exactly like what you were just hinting at. Is a one-party state, what I'd call the difference between big D and little d democratic organization. You know, the UAW-CIO, today's UAW, is written up for good reasons. It's very progressive in lots of ways, but in the state of Michigan, I don't know if you saw my outline of some thoughts about this right to work thing in the fall. One theory of why it happened was that our state labor movement's too dominated by the UAW, and the leadership at the time thought it was a good idea to go ahead with this proposal to make the state constitution not allow right to work. And when it badly failed, some would argue that's what opened up the governor to agreeing to do it. Others say, no, he was going to sign it regardless. But it's a debate. So,
yeah.
But the notion of in a state where one union dominates so much maybe has some negatives is something that historians are interested in.
Well, perhaps, and I don't know. I mean, it's part of the whole problem is how is labor's political power real or fictional? And of course, even if it's fictional, it's real because the perception that you have clout is as good as having the clout. It's I'm kind of curious as to, you know, nowadays when we're apparently going to lose the free trade. I mean, the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right.
Fast Track, but And they're characterizing it as kind of, you know, labor's defeat because we're the principal opponents. Well, there's a number of opponents to it, but I guess maybe we are. But with, you know, about 10% of workers organized, how the hell much strength do we have? And we certainly with the growing right to work movement, it's going to sap a lot of our monetary resources when it comes to helping out candidates. So there's no question that our political clout is going to be quite a bit reduced. And I mean, you make a good point. I mean, how could right to work happen in Wisconsin? Not live in theory. And I don't want to get into that now. But
maybe in a couple of weeks we could have that conversation. How's that sound?
Well, we've got to flesh out our event in October.
Right, that's what I mean. Would it be helpful to chat about that, and I would think about Michigan?
Well, I don't know if we need to spend much time on it.
Okay.
Yet. I mean, I think what I need to put my thoughts to together, and they kind of want a paper, and even though it's only 15 minutes long, maybe I can put together something that...
I was curious what you thought about the New York Times article of June 14th in the magazine.
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, the guy interviewed me, too, so I was aware that it was coming on. Interestingly, the fact checker who checked the story out called me several times on various points. So it was really kind of an interesting process.
Well, I thought so, and that's partly why I'd like to ask you some questions about it, because I've never heard of Dan Kaufman, the author, before.
And he's apparently almost a freelance writer.
I think that...
Because my son's a professional musician in New York, and I thought he might know him, he and I exchanged some emails. And he's got a website for his musicianship, and he's a freelance writer who has done several articles for the New York Times magazine. He appears to be in his middle 30s.
Uh-huh.
And very interesting guy in the sense that he came by, he was in town during the Bayview tragedy, a commemoration that we had on May 3rd, which he describes, and he had only, as far as I can tell, the article is accurate as hell with one minor error. And, but anyway, I told Dan, because he told me earlier in the week that he was going to stop by, and he'd possibly stop by. He said, well, he could stop by, you know, come up and say hi. But he never did.
Okay.
But I found out from the fact checker that he did show up. So I said, well, it's kind of strange he didn't come by and say hi. But then I was very busy because I chaired the thing.
Right.
And you know, do a lot of talking. So maybe he came by and I was talking to somebody and he just gave up. But whatever, he spent a lot of time on it and a lot of research. So
did you agree with me that it was pretty well done, pretty accurate?
By all means, yeah. No,
okay.
In fact, I wrote him in a communication afterwards, and I said, trying to look at it from an unbiased point of view and that of a former newspaper man myself, I want to praise you for the rather complete and balanced job.
I was impressed. I've sent it off to a couple other friends and colleagues to say this is useful.
Yeah, and it's a very useful article.
There were a couple things I wasn't certain. I think I told a good friend of mine who's well versed in labor relations, one of my mentors, and I told Bob that I really did think it was well done. And I thought there may have been one or two minor details from way back that I'm not sure I'd agree with, but I'm not sure all historians would agree with me. So,
I think as far as the facts go, he was right on. I don't think there was any sloppy reporting. There may have been an interpretation that might not quite like.
Yeah.
That doesn't bother me too much.
So, I'm fine with us quitting now.
Yeah, I am too.
The recorder I'm using says we talked 1 hour. And 48, 49, 50 seconds, it's ticking off, which I think is more than enough.
I agree.
I would be fine that you kind of told me about your first thoughts on these three things, and I'd be fine that we look at, like, a couple weeks from now, after you go fishing.
Yeah, that's okay, and then I'm not sure what days I'll be free, because I've got a fairly busy schedule in July. But,
do you want to send me an email in a couple of weeks and let me know what you think is another good date?
Sure, and then I'd like to focus in on whatever we think we should talk about and not stray off, because we did.
Okay.
We all have, both of us have tons of experience, and we could talk for hours on any of those topics, so we need to zero in, I think.
Okay. Well, I think I told you, but if not, I'll repeat it shortly. So I'm a newer retiree than you. I'm also maybe less disciplined than you. I've been deciding to go with volunteering to write or give papers for conferences, and then based on who says yes, then that's what I go with. Obviously, things that really interest me are more important. So I volunteered us for Right to Work in the fall, so that's a focus. I was about to volunteer us for something next spring, like April or something. The labor educators are meeting in D.C., and I think I told you it was about discrimination. So I kind of thought that was a topic we could talk about. Which of us shows up, or if we send a paper, that doesn't matter, but it's a focus. And then the following fall for Detroit, Tom Klug seems interested in us just doing something about AIW. So, at the moment, those are kind of my three focuses. I need to look at some interviews you did and vice versa. Is that okay, or you want something more defined than that, Ken?
No, that's fine, and then maybe we can talk. By the way, I did give you the link to my personal oral history guide.
Okay. I can't look at it right now on the computer, sorry.
No, but I did give you that link. That's all I'm asking.
It's a link to what?
I did about an 8-hour, 10-hour interview on my life with Michael Gordon at UWM here.
I'm sorry, I don't know that I've ever seen that or even known that you did that.
It's available online, and I will send you a
Please
link. It's
do.
An oral interview. It's audio.
No, I don't believe I know about this.
And I'll send you a link on it, and it's also been transcribed. And I think I've got that on PDF.
No,
I'll send you the entire PDF. It's about 78 pages.
This is all news. No, I don't recall this at all, Ken.
Well, that'll give you more than you need to know about me.
And it'll help me for asking more questions.
Yeah, it'll give you more than you want to know, probably. But anyway.
I mean,
and,
uh, I... on the personal level, I am interested still a little bit about the Labor History Society. That itself is a historical thing now.
Yeah.
That hasn't been much written about. And it's something that I have a joke with my family about. I'm doing memoirs because my father-in-law actually did an online memoir, which everybody loves. And so I joked that I was starting one. And so sometimes I just type and write some story or I do something and I set it aside. So there are some things about you that I don't know and I'd like to know more, like the Labor History Society and how it relates to ours. The whole story about your interviewing Washburn and what you knew and then how that ended up that Lisa Fine used it and it disappeared and... And I still don't even know if I
have... You have the transcript of that, don't you?
I looked for it before this, and I couldn't find it.
Okay, you don't have that.
I don't think so.
I would have to... It's not on PDF yet. I'll have to copy it, because it's quite long.
I don't think so, and as you recall, within the last 6 months is when I raised the issue, and I found this old email between her and I when she said she was no longer interested in doing anything, because she was with me at a Walt Campbell interview. And actually, some of your comments about the AIW and anti-communism are a little different than what we got out of that interview with Walt.
Well, that would be interesting.
Which was about the Lovestoneites.
Well, I didn't get into that. But
right. And you may know all that story. I don't know. But anyways, Lisa makes some reference in her Rio Joe, and she praises you for having done this Washburn interview. And it's all of interest to me because I was actually trying to catch up to him to interview him myself because I think Bob Ripas knew him. And another variation on that story is you mentioned about the AIW and arbitration, and one of my mentors in labor ed, Bob Ripas, wrote an article about how the AIW was unique in that they held out against arbitration longer than most other unions because they wanted to retain the right to strike. So...
Okay, well, that's different than my...
I understand, and so that was a comment I wrote in the side of my notes here going, ask Ken about that later.
Now, he's right about Michigan. He's totally right about...
That's all he was talking about.
Yeah. Oh, he's totally right there.
Okay.
Because there was the reluctance, and I think as late as the 70s, some of our locals in Michigan still did not have arbitration.
Now, that's exactly what he wrote about.
No, he's totally right on that.
And he was comparing it to the UAW-CIO and other unions who accepted out of World War II arbitration as the way to resolve this stuff. And the AIW held out on West Michigan saying, no, we want to retain the right to threat to strike.
Right. There was a real militant unionism going on in Western Michigan with our people at that time.
Yeah, okay. So, anyways, details, and I jotted notes on the side, so.
Okay.
Alrighty.
I will send you that stuff. I'll contact that guy. Louise.
Great.
And
I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did.
It always is interesting.
Okay.
So take care, John.
Alrighty. Thanks, Ken.